Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, you might not recognize the name of Tom Steyer, but that soon might change. He's bankrolled a number of California's ballot measures. Now the billionaire investment manager may have political ambition himself, as his name is being bandied about as a potential challenger for Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, the open seat of Governor Jerry Brown, and maybe even the presidency itself. We'll find out what he has to say about those rumors and what he wants to do in the San Joaquin Valley. Plus, what's the future for the troubled Tulare Regional Medical Center? Nurses have walked off the job after not getting paid. The company that runs the hospital says it's had enough, and the board has voted to pursue bankruptcy. What does that mean for the community and the hospital? That's coming up later in our program. We begin, though, with a local look at the tragedy this past weekend in Las Vegas. Law enforcement officials are still busy putting together the pieces of what led to the deadliest mass shooting in modern American history. A number of Valley residents were at the Country Music Festival on the Las Vegas Strip. Valley native Janine Evans is one of those people. She spoke with Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess about what happened when the bullets began to rain down.
Where were you last night?
Well, we were at the concert. We were we're normally towards the front. The last two nights we've been at the front, the very front of the concert. But this time, you know, we were sick of everybody, kind of all the crowd and being pushed on and all the drunks. And so we decided to hang out in the back where we could actually breathe and be a little cooler and enjoy the show. You know, I just can't believe, you know, how lucky we are and blessed. And I feel so bad for everyone else that got caught up in this and you know, the families that lost their loved ones. And but we, you know, we're thankful to be alive. We're thankful we ran out of there as quick as we could. I grabbed my sister's hand and said, let's go. You know, and we just started running and I lost my flip flop and just gobs and gobs of people. And they opened up the barricades that were closed. So everybody could just go and get out.
What did you hear? So what was going on at the concert and what did you hear?
Okay, we were standing, you know, at the concert, and there's actually two police officers standing to the right of us, and we all heard everything at the same time. It was to the right of us. We could tell it was coming from, you know, Mandalay Bay's to the right of us, and we didn't know where it was coming from. If it was, you know, somebody on the street, somebody in a hotel, we couldn't tell that. All we knew was loud, and it was constant. And so we were like, first, like, we thought it was part of the show. Maybe, like they said, the pyrotechnics or sort of firecrackers or something, but you know, even the cops were like looking up and like started walking slowly towards the gunfire or towards the sound anyway. And we're like, everybody started getting down and screaming. You saw people start to run. And I'm like, let's go. I grabbed my sister's hand and we ran. We ran as fast as we could out of there. And first we were behind a vendor's trailer and then we moved over. When we were on the sidewalk, I felt like a sitting duck, you know. So we went behind a cement wall. We hunkered down there for a little while. And then the cop ran up to us and said, you guys got to get out of here. Go. So then we ran around this other concrete wall by a gas station, and there was like a, I don't know, maybe a foot or two wide, and it had like a bunch of broken up cement blocks, and we just laid down in that until we thought it was safe to get up and move. I had a concrete boulder in front of my head, you know, thinking I was going to get hit in the head, but it was just constant gunfire, and it was loud. It seemed like it was getting louder and louder, and like it was getting closer and closer, but anyway, we finally got up and decided to make a run for it. And everybody else is waiting for the cars to stop because the cars don't know what's going on. You know, the cars on the strip, they didn't know what's going on. All you see are all these people running. They're probably just thinking that, you know, those concert was released and we're just being crazy people. But yeah, it was chaos.
I've seen the video, which you may or may not have seen, but there's a video that captured the gunfire and you said it's constant from the video. That's terrifying. What did it sound like in real life?
Just like you're in a war zone. I mean, it was undescribable, just loud and constant, like it was belt fed, but you know, I don't think it was, but just definitely an assault rifle. And we thought we were going to die. You just wanted to run and get out of there.
Especially,
and all the screaming and everybody running. It was just pandemonium. It was just scary.
Especially, you mentioned how in that kind of environment, I don't know how much familiarity you have with guns, but when you get into that kind of place, it's almost impossible to tell where the shooting's even coming from. What was that
like? Exactly. All we knew is it sounded like it was coming from our right, for sure. We knew it was from our right, and that was the direction of Mandalay Bay. And we were facing the stage, and like I said, he was like into his third or fourth song, and the lights in the show went out, and he, you know, was gone. And we're like, oh, something's up. You know, those aren't fireworks. And then when it was started just constant again. And, you know, I've heard gunfire before. I know what it sounds like, but to be where it's live like that and just constant. And it, obviously it was someone wanting to put some hurt on some people.
And so I can't even imagine, like, if you don't know specifically where it's coming from, where do you run? Like, how do you even make that decision where to go?
Exactly. Well, I just assumed, I guess, that it was probably at the front. You know, maybe I didn't know if the Jason Aldean was the target or if the people all up front, you know, you don't know, but you're not going to just stand there either. So you had to make a decision. You're going to sit there or you're going to run. So it sounded like it was to the front and the right of me and my sister. So we just ran backwards. We ran back towards the hotel. And I'm glad we did, because a lot of people, I feel bad, they were locked out of their hotel rooms. You know, everything's on lockdown, so they were stranded. They, you know, they couldn't go anywhere.
Because I got to say, it seems like you're handling this remarkably well. Are you still in a state of shock? Like, I mean, you're being very articulate for someone who just survived a...
No, I've had some training. I do know how to stay calm. I was trying to calm other people down. But, you know, a lot of them were just like in one ear and out the other. They were just straight, you know, of course, they're just traumatized. And I understand that. But, you know, you still want to try and help them. But, yeah, the worst thing you could do is panic and lose, you know, your mind capabilities. You got to think, you got to react, you got to do what you got to do to get out of there.
How long did this all go on for?
Too long. It was at least, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. It was just, and it's not an exaggeration. It seemed like it was just ongoing. You think it was done and then he'd start up again. And in between is when we try and get up and run when it was stopped, you know. And then to be on the sidewalk and hear the gunfire again is the most awful feeling in the world. So we hid behind a concrete wall, and then once it stopped again, the cop ran up to us and said, you guys gotta go, you gotta get out of here, just go run. And so we're like, oh, okay. And like I said, I'm running with one shoe, one sandal. I had one flip flop on and one off, and you know, you don't care, you just go.
And again, I apologize for asking a question like this in this way, but as far as entering the concert, fairly typical security there. I know the shooter was outside of the concert.
Security was awesome. There was a whole bunch of security. There's all kinds of security, event staff. They were great. They did their jobs.
But it really seems like there's not, you mentioned the officers too, who deserve credit as well, but it seems like there's nothing, it really seems like there's nothing security wise that could have been done.
There's always going to be that one person that finds all the loopholes and knows exactly what to do. He had a, I don't know, the news said he had a companion that worked at the hotel and kind of knew the ins and outs, and that's basically what these, you know, crazy people do, is they sit back and look for loopholes and what they can get away with. And that's all it was. You know, I don't think there was any one person that you can blame this on or anything that could have been done to prevent this. Really, I mean, I think all in all, you know, the law enforcement here was amazing and did everything they could do to prevent it. I mean, I'm definitely not for me to say. I don't know.
Any message you would have, any family or anything you would like the opportunity to say?
Well, I love my family to death, and I'm going to hug them that much, you know, harder and closer. And I have a son in the military. And I think about him, you know, and I have another boy at home waiting for me to come home. And, I just want all my family and friends to know that I love them very much. And my sister, the same way.
That was Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess interviewing Valley native Janine Evans. She was at the concert with her sister and friends when the shooting broke out on Sunday night. This is Valley Edition. Earlier this summer, a contract between Calviva Health and Kaiser Permanente left 9,000 Medi-Cal patients in the San Joaquin Valley to find all new doctors. We were curious how that transition happened. FM 89's Carrie Klein set out to find out how significant this change was in the healthcare world and how doctors and patients experienced it.
Carlo DiCicco has been on hold for about 7 minutes. When an operator answers, he nearly drops the phone.
Yeah. Hello?
He's on the phone with his daughter's health insurance network.
I'm trying to call to see what I can do with my daughter, where I can take her to see a psychiatrist.
DeChico's teenage daughter suffers from chronic depression. She's been a Kaiser Permanente patient for around 10 years, seeing a child psychiatrist who knows her needs and can adjust her medication. So it was a shock when a letter arrived in July telling DeChico on September 1st, his daughter wouldn't have access to that doctor or any others at Kaiser.
To get notification basically a little over a month out with no real solid foundation to what's happening, shows that there wasn't real too much foresight put into it.
The contract termination between Calviva and Kaiser affects about 9,000 Medi-Cal patients in Fresno, Madera, and Kings counties. As far as numbers go, this shift in care is actually pretty small scale, but it takes place in an area suffering from high rates of chronic disease that's already in the midst of a doctor shortage. And to those affected by the contract change, it's significant, especially because this is supposed to be the health safety net. Both Calviva and Kaiser say they're working to make the transition as smooth as possible, but it still brings out the helplessness patients feel when tossed from network to network.
So ideally, I'll be able to make a phone call and know by the end of the week my daughter can go see a psychiatrist. Reality is, I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Calviva Health is a health insurer through the Medi-Cal Managed Care Program. It's a public, nonprofit health plan sponsored by a regional health authority in Fresno, Madera, and Kings counties. In this contract, Kaiser was the provider network, and Calviva reimbursed Kaiser doctors for seeing Medi-Cal patients. As to how the contract ended, neither Calviva nor Kaiser agreed to an interview, but they both answered questions by email. Kaiser claims Calviva terminated the contract without cause, and Calviva claims Kaiser wouldn't accept any of its proposed agreements. Contracts like this are at work all throughout our healthcare system. And Anthony Wright of the advocacy nonprofit Health Access says changes do happen all the time.
And it's actually sort of the byproduct of how we do healthcare, for better or worse, in our state and in our country, where it's largely a market-driven system based on negotiations between insurers and providers.
Nadare Porat of UCLA's Fielding School of Public Health says this isn't all that surprising coming from Kaiser.
There are some health plans that actually take on, enroll a lot of the Medi-Cal population, and some that historically have not taken on a large proportion. Kaiser is one of those.
4 years ago, Medi-Cal beneficiaries made up about 6% of Kaiser patients. Today, they're just 1.6%. Part of what makes this transition difficult is that Kaiser providers don't accept any other insurance plans. Janet Kaufman of UCSF's Institute for Health Policy Studies says this leaves patients to rebuild their care networks from scratch.
And not just your doctors. You're going to be going to a new hospital. You're going to need to find a different lab. You're going to need to find a different pharmacy.
Kaufman says what's concerning about this situation is that it happened to Medi-Cal patients in an already underserved area. Moving forward, she says, continuity of care is key, especially for those with chronic diseases and complex histories. Calviva claims it has a plan. For every patient pushed out of Kaiser, it claims it assigned them a new in-network primary care doctor. Carlo DeChico doesn't recall ever being notified of that. The caretaker of another Calviva patient reported the same experience. But Steve Schilling, CEO of Clinica Sierra Vista, says he agreed to accept about 800 of Calviva's patients into his clinics.
We've been given a list of names of the folks they would expect to be assigning to our PCP health centers in Fresno. And we have been reaching out to them, both by telephone and by letter, over the last 30 days.
Dr. Raul Ayala, a family practitioner and chief medical officer of Adventist Health, says his clinics were assigned around 1,000 patients. He says it'll be a tough squeeze, but they're used to it.
It happens all the time. We're constantly going through these changes. So I think we've just kind of gotten used to healthcare changing that fast.
Even for those doctors with the capacity for new patients, there's no telling how long wait times could be. Carlo DeChico was lucky. He was eventually connected with a psychiatrist, and while scheduling, another patient canceled. He got an appointment for his daughter yesterday. He says it went well. But others may not be so lucky. Before DeChico was offered this appointment, he was told he'd have to wait until December. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
Of course, long wait times are not a problem unique to those people now searching for a new doctor through CalViva. It's a problem faced by many throughout the San Joaquin Valley. It was also the subject of a major series that recently wrapped up here on FM 89 by our own Carrie Klein. It's called Struggling for Care, and you can find all those stories on our website. But Carrie now joins us in the studio to tell us a little more and to bring us up to date on some developments. First of all, Carrie, tell us a little more about what the series talked about for those of our listeners who maybe didn't hear it.
Right. Hi, Joe. So yeah, essentially, it's about the fact that we really are short on providers here in the San Joaquin Valley. When it comes to primary care providers specifically, we've got about 35% fewer than what the state recommends. That's huge. We're also short on specialists and other providers. So this series was really an attempt to answer why and how this happened, and also what's being done about it.
Now, this is part of the California Health Journalism Fellowship from the USC Annenberg School of Communication. So we reported on this over, about 6 months, looking at all these different stories. And again, you can find them at kvpr.org under Struggling for Care. What has changed? This healthcare world is pretty fast moving. Have there been any developments since those stories aired earlier this summer?
Yeah, there have been quite a lot of developments. We'll start with the good news. That's that that St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno has announced that it's created a new residency program. And now I knew that this was coming. Didn't know exactly when, but they announced that starting 2018, they expect to be enrolling, starting with an internal medicine program, it'll go up to 120 residents within a couple of years. So that's really big. That's going to be one of the bigger ones here in the Valley.
Now, in some ways, does that underscore what you reported in your story about the challenges for expanding these residency programs with the federal budget cap? That was specific to existing residency programs. So that's where the budget kerfuffle is?
Yeah, exactly. There's a cap, a 20-year-old cap on the number of residents that teaching hospitals can have, but that's only existing teaching hospitals.
So they can't grow the existing ones as they would like to with federal dollars, at least,
mm-hmm.
but new ones can start.
Exactly. So St. Agnes is now becoming a teaching hospital, and they have 5 years before they run into their own cap. So they have to really ramp up and hit the ground running, and after 5 years, they cannot grow beyond that amount.
Do we know how many slots are going to be in that program?
Mm-hmm. There'll be 120 in total, and they'll have a couple different programs, starting with internal medicine, and then over a couple years, they'll ramp up to a few others.
So that's a big step for that Valley Hospital, and a bit of good news in this story.
Mm-hmm.
We're always looking for that. What about maybe less good news?
So yeah, the bad news, I guess, there are a few things that kind of affect the supply of doctors immediately, and then those that kind of affect the doctor pipeline coming up. So more immediately, we just had this story about CalViva and Kaiser. There are a lot of Medi-Cal patients searching for doctors now. But of course, there's been a lot of uncertainty in Congress lately around healthcare policy. The Graham-Cassidy healthcare bill ultimately failed, but it interfered with Congress voting on a bunch of other key pieces of health legislation. So first, there's the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. It provides Medicaid benefits to about 9 million kids throughout the country, and about 2 million of those kids are in California. Congress let this program expire on Saturday night. So that means there's no federal funding for it. There's some state funding, but it could run out as soon as January 2018. But of course, the federal government could still make an allotment for this in its budget that it's going to decide on the next month. But if not, it could really be bad news here in California in January.
Now, there were other programs also that were mentioned as part of this healthcare cliff, to speak, September 30.
Yep, absolutely. There's the Community Health Center Fund, which provides a huge amount of funding for community health centers. That includes a lot of federally qualified centers like Clinica Sierra Vista, like Adventist Clinics, Camarena Health. Again, if Congress does not act, well, they let it expire on Saturday. And if they do not act to include it in the federal budget in the next month, those clinics could all face a loss of 70% of their funding.
Now, I know you spoke with some people at those clinics. What did they tell you? How dire is their situation on the panic level? How are they right now?
Well, there wasn't panic immediately, also because they weren't quite sure what Congress was going to do. I think they had faith. And then Congress, of course, did let this expire. So, I'm sure their hearts dropped a little bit. But I know at least, at Clinica Sierra Vista, they expect that immediately it'll just mean they kind of have to stop expanding their programs. They have to stop thinking about growing new clinics, hiring lots of new folks. And then sometime next year is when they may actually start having to do layoffs. It won't be immediate, but it could still be pretty bad in the long term.
So bad news on that front in healthcare.
Yep, that's right. Of course, there was also funding for teaching health centers that was on the line. That eventually was passed, actually. So that's good news. Our teaching health centers, which are small residency programs in rural underserved areas, those have preserved their funding for at least the next couple of years.
So kind of a mixed bag. Some good news, some less good news.
That's right. And a little bit more, too, which has to do with immigration. Of course, we have a huge number of foreign educated doctors here in the Valley. President Trump recently announced that he would repeal DACA. That could affect the pipeline. A lot of Dreamers right now are at the age to either be thinking about or enrolled in medical school and residency programs. So getting rid of DACA could really impact future doctors in that way. There's also the latest travel ban, which bars residents of 7 countries from entering the U.S. That could do the same to our doctor pipeline. And right now we have a lot of doctors in this valley from those banned countries, quite a number from Iran and Syria. There's also doctors from Venezuela, Libya, and Sudan.
So that's the key focus of that last report in your series. You can find all of those pieces on our website, strugglingforcare at kvpr.org. Carrie Klein with us today. Now, looking at this series, it wasn't just the reported pieces you did on the air. It was also a bit of a two-way street in that we were asking listeners for their experiences. How did they factor into this project?
Yeah, well, so it was really important to me from the beginning to really understand what this means at the patient level, at the individual resident level here in San Joaquin Valley. This is obviously an issue that really resonated for people because we asked and our listeners really delivered. So many of our listeners may remember hearing an on-air promo to call our tip line with stories about doctor shortages, and we got quite a lot of feedback. It worked. And some of these were really personal, gut-wrenching stories. We're putting some of these on the web that I'll tell you about afterwards. But first, here's an excerpt from what a woman named Angie told me. Angie lives in Bakersfield. She was diagnosed with cancer last year, and she has to commute to Los Angeles for her treatments.
Going out of town with those symptoms is already difficult enough, but now I'm disrupting not only my life, but I'm disrupting the life of family members because now they have to request time off of work and look for childcare and find other family members to step in and take over their responsibilities.
So finding those physicians, a common theme, whether it's the report we heard earlier this morning about Calviva and Kaiser or people like we just heard there in Bakersfield, was that really the biggest common thread that you saw in the responses that you heard from people, or were there other things that came out of it?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of different angles to this and a lot of ways that this really disrupts people's lives and their health, of course. Here's another story. This is from Jasmine in Merced. She says she developed an excruciating stomach ache just after Thanksgiving a few years ago. She eventually ended up in the ER with appendicitis, where she was operated on. But that wasn't until after she had tried to make an appointment with her doctor.
I don't know if I made it clear to the young lady on the other line that my stomach was really hurting. But she told me that her next available appointment was, it was a while back, but it was either in March or May. It was just kind of eye-opening to think like, wow, if I really had an emergency, I don't have a doctor, actually.
Another very powerful story there, and that anecdote on our website, kvpr.org. Tell us some more about that. How can people find some more of these personal accounts?
Yeah, so I've put together a whole collection of these testimonials and put them on a map on our website. So it's a post like any other story. If you go to our website, kvpr.org, you can find this map and click around to hear the rest of these stories from people really across the valley.
Again, kvpr.org. Look for the series Struggling for Care about the Valley's ongoing doctor shortage. Carrie Klein, our health reporter here at Valley Public Radio. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition. We'll talk to billionaire investment advisor and potential gubernatorial candidate, maybe even presidential candidate, Tom Steyer. We'll find out what he's doing in the Valley, and we'll find out about the future of the troubled Tulare Regional Medical Center. That's all coming up on Valley Edition, straight ahead on FM 89. This is Valley Edition.
The future of the troubled Tulare Regional Medical Center is in doubt today as a long simmering dispute over the management and operation of the hospital has boiled over. The elected board of the public hospital has voted to pursue Chapter 9 bankruptcy proceedings after a week that saw nurses go unpaid and services shut down. It's all the result of a dispute between the hospital's board and the private company that has run the hospital, which is known as Healthcare Conglomerate Associates. Joining us now, we have a member of the board of the Tulare Local Healthcare District, which is, again, the elected body that runs and oversees TRMC. Kevin Northcraft joins us now. Kevin, welcome.
Thank you.
Kevin, let's start out with this. What's the state of services at the hospital presently as we talk on this Tuesday morning? A lot has been changing.
I wish I could tell you more. We're pretty well shut out of information. Our management company does not share any information with us about what's going on at the hospital, nor does it respond to any of our requests. From what I'm hearing is that they're down to a handful of patients, and that because of their failure to pay for services, doctors, maids, food services, and today I heard even security may not be present. So it's a very difficult situation. We're doing what we can to kind of reset the hospital through the Chapter 9 filing that we did on Saturday to try to amend or reject the contract that we have with HCCA. It's undoubtedly the worst contract in the history of public hospitals. It pays them about $8 million a year, 10 times over the market rate for administration, and it pays them to an individual who has never managed a hospital before. And we really need some dramatic changes, and hopefully we're on our way to doing that. I think the community is coming together. The last election was over 80% in support of the changes we wish to make. So,
and you're talking about the recall.
Sounds like a lot of trouble, but hopefully brighter days are ahead.
You're talking about the recall election earlier this summer. Now, I want to go back to what you said initially. You're on the board of the Tulare Hospital District, but you don't actually know what's going on at the hospital right now due to this dispute? Is that your understanding here?
That's correct. The contract signed by the prior board, that are now all gone, really leases the entire facility out to a private company. The contract even provides we're not allowed to even enter the premises without prior approval of that company. It's an impossible contract. It doesn't have any performance standards, and it's an irrevocable 15-year contract. So basically, they can ignore, and they are ignoring, our request for information. We've been asking for accounts payable information since January and have never received it, or we would have at least known a little bit more about the position they placed us in. But like I say, they're better days are ahead, we think, through this Chapter 9 filing should allow us to restart and ideally get somebody competent in there to restore our public hospital and begin again to provide the quality services our community needs.
Now, HCCA isn't really talking to the media right now, given the present circumstances, but in the past, they have said that they had improved finances at the hospital and the operations of the facility since they took over, and recently, they were quoted in the Times Delta as saying, you know, we no longer have the support of this board. We aren't moving forward with them then. How do you assess, or how do you characterize what happened here with HCCA? How did things deteriorate so much?
If you read the contract, it is so one-sided, it's hard to understand there's any benefit to the public and to the hospital users. normally when you lease out a facility, the person that's has occupancy of the facility pays the landlord. In this case, we're the landlord and we're paying the tenant $8 million a year to operate our hospital. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I think the community has come together by very high percentages to say we want a basic change in this. And obviously the company that has enormously benefited from this one-sided agreement is not wanting to make any changes.
So your board on Saturday voted to pursue Chapter 9 bankruptcy proceedings. What specifically does that mean? There's a lot of different chapters in bankruptcy law. Chapter 9 has some specific features. How do they relate to your future plans for the hospital?
Yes, it's different. The reason I hesitate to call it bankruptcy because I think it conjures up something a lot different than what we're really dealing with as a public agency. In Chapter 9, the elected officials retain a lot of control. We decide the bills are to be paid. It's not taken over by an independent trustee. And it doesn't mean you're going out of business. It means you're hitting the reset button and you have an opportunity to look at your creditors and make some changes. Look at your existing obligations and determine what needs to be changed to improve the situation. Other hospitals have been through this, and within a short period of time are back on the road to success. And we would certainly hope that. We have a population in our district of about 70,000 people. A well-run public hospital should have no problem making ends meet and being successful and providing basic hospital services to the community they serve.
In your view, does this all stem back at some level to the failed tower expansion or the stalled tower expansion that began well over a decade ago? Is that the root of this problem?
No, that's more the symptom of it, I think. There were some mistakes made, and some of that was before HCCA. But the prior board, for whatever reason, and no one seems to understand it, picked the worst option that we had back in 2014 to hire this company that was just created to operate our hospital. And they've alienated the doctors, and with the doctors leaving, the patients leave. It's just been a very unsuccessful attempt to bring our hospital back. The impetus probably was the tower, but in 3 years, this current operator has done nothing to complete the tower. So it's not, it hasn't been a success in any regard. It certainly has hurt operations at the hospital. It's driven our patients and our doctors to other hospitals. Some big changes really need to be made and made soon.
And there was that effort to pass a bond before voters in Tulare, I believe it was last year, seeking funding for continuing construction on that facility. It was rejected by voters. So what's the next step here for TRMC? This filing, have you actually filed Chapter 9, or is this just a vote to pursue that option?
The paperwork was filed on Saturday after our authorization on Friday night. So it is proceeding. I'm meeting with our legal advisors today to see what the next steps are. We are hoping that we can make an amicable separation and get someone in there that has instant credibility to bring back our hospital and bring back our doctors and bring back our patients. Given the history with HCCA, that may be overly optimistic, but we are still hopeful that we can turn this around on a fairly quick basis.
So what happens to the employees who were essentially left without a paycheck last week? Have they reached out to your board? I know they are not your employees because they work for HCCA, but have they reached out to you in any way? Have you heard from them?
Yes, we've heard from quite a few, and that is one of our concerns after the patients are the employees. And it's, to no fault of their own, they're going through all this anxiety and not knowing if you're going to get paid. And I can't guarantee that that's going to be resolved quickly, but it's certainly our interest in trying to help them and make sure they're paid. They were all finally paid last Friday. And so in 2 weeks is the question whether that payroll can be accomplished.
So let's say the Chapter 9 proceeding moves forward. You have some sort of a departure from the current company that runs the hospital. How do you foresee the future operation of TRMC working? Would there be another company that would come in to operate the facility under your board's overall leadership? Or would it be partnering with another area healthcare institution or running the hospital directly as the board and hiring the management team yourself? How do you see that?
I think all those options are available to us. I lean towards a partnership with somebody that would give us instant credibility and restore some of the image that's been damaged in the past few years. On an interim basis, at least, and then give us a breather and a chance to look long-term about how we want to proceed. But regardless, I think the interest of the community is that we maintain it as a public hospital and that our elected officials have a say in how the hospital moves forward, which was given up with this contract back in 2014 by the prior board. So we'll never have a contract that delegates all that responsibility to a private for-profit company again, and in my way of thinking anyway.
Before we go, you mentioned restoring that somewhat tarnished reputation among the public. How do you do that, and what is the perception out there right now? Certainly the hospital's had some really serious challenges, both under HCCA and even before them, with the tower, with some quality ratings from the state, and now this. How do you begin to rebuild that trust and that brand of TRMC with the public?
One step at a time. There was a time we were the gem of the valley in terms of hospitals. I think getting somebody with credibility to help us, bringing our doctors back, improving our facilities, working with our public, being responsive to the needs of the public. I think there's a lot of interest in the community. The community is a very strong community, and they've come together on this issue. I think we can do it. It will take time. Knocking on doors last year, there were a lot of people saying, even though they're paying taxes to support that hospital, that they'd never step foot in it. And we need to overcome that. We need to convince our public that we have made changes to improve and provide a quality first-class hospital, which our area needs. We've got certainly enough population to sustain a active hospital. And I think in time it will happen, but it won't be without a lot of hard work.
We've been talking with Kevin Northcraft. He is a board member with the Tulare Local Healthcare District, which runs Tulare Regional Medical Center. For the last few years, it has been delegating that responsibility to a for-profit company running the hospital healthcare conglomerate associates, and that relationship has devolved to the state that earlier this past weekend, the hospital board voted to pursue Chapter 9 bankruptcy proceedings. Kevin, we wish you and everyone in Tulare all the best.
Okay. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the needs of our hospital and our community.
Thanks a lot. This is Valley Edition.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Tom Steyer may be one of the most influential Californians you've never heard of, but that may change. Speculation about a potential run for governor, the U.S. Senate, or even the presidency has thrust his name back into the headlines. But the Democrat and environmental activist is not a stranger to politics. He's been the driving force behind a number of California ballot measures, including most recently the one that raised the state's tobacco tax. He's also founded the group Next Gen Climate, which is a nonprofit focused on climate change, which has since rebranded itself as Next Gen America. He joins us now. Tom, welcome.
Joe, thank you very much for having me.
Before we get into some of the heart of the matter and some of the things you're working on with your group here in the San Joaquin Valley, I just want to get it out of the way. Capital Public Radio had you on and asked if you would rule out running against Dianne Feinstein. You declined to rule that out. Just talking in general, could you see yourself running for office in the near future?
I feel as if we're in a gigantic political crisis. And I have spent the last 5 years full time working to try and push for a broader democracy and a more progressive California and a more progressive America. And so in that effort, I have not ruled out anything because I feel as if whatever I'm really searching for the way to contribute as much as I can at a time of what I think of as American political crisis. I haven't ruled anything out, but I also haven't made any decision about running for any office.
Earlier this year, you told the PPIC in California at an event in Sacramento that you think the threat to democracy we're seeing coming out of Washington, this is a quote, is as profound as I've seen in my lifetime. Has anything changed in your assessment since you said that in May?
I would say it's more profound than any time I've seen in my lifetime. I believe that this administration has been systematically going after the rights of different groups in America, starting obviously with immigrant rights, a woman's right to choose. They have been trying to prevent African Americans around the country from exercising their right to vote. They are continuously and strongly fighting against working people's right to organize in the marketplace. They have been speaking out against LGBTQ rights. And I think that when you look at their unwillingness to unequivocally separate themselves from the overt racists and hate groups in the so-called alt-right, you see an attitude about America where they don't feel as if every citizen has the same political rights and has the same rights to respect and dignity. And that's something which we absolutely disagree with. So I would say I've never imagined that we would see a president who could not unequivocally condemn neo-Nazis and the KKK. That's a level I never thought I'd live to see.
One of the big questions out there right now as we go into another election season is how should parties respond? In fact, how should even Republicans respond? But Democrats are asking that question, too. You are a Democrat. And I want to ask you, where do you fall on this question? Should the party go left? Should it go more centrist in its effort to regain the House and maybe retake the White House in 2020? How do you see that existential question for what is the future of the Democratic Party?
Joe, it's funny. I don't really see it in those terms. I believe the job of the Democratic Party is to stick to our basic values. I mean, I was just saying every American has the same political rights and privileges. Every American has the same right to respect and dignity. To stick to those values and to use them to come out with a vision for the future which supports the American people, which talks about how to invest in our future, invest in our people, talks about building a clean America, and talks about standing up for the rights of every individual American. And I think if we do that, I don't know if that's left, right, or center. That to me is just standing up for basic American values, the kinds of things that animate people in every part of this state and every part of this country, and that means that we're actually responding to the day-to-day needs of citizens. If we do that, I don't know how to characterize it, but that's the job of the Democratic Party. And if we do that, we'll do fine.
But there's also a lot of concern amongst Democratic voters, many of whom supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. How do Democrats manage to build that coalition amongst people who maybe are disillusioned by the way the last electoral primary season went?
Well, I think that all of this revolves around being close to the grassroots. I don't know if you know this, but Next Gen America, our organization, might be, it's one of the biggest or the biggest grassroots organizations in the United States. So I believe it all revolves around being close to people and understanding what's going on at the community level and also having a vision for the future. So when you look at those kids who supported Senator Sanders, look at what Senator Sanders is saying now. He's saying we need a single-payer healthcare system. He's looking to the future and saying, what is a vision that is better for this country? And I think that it's clear that it's time for that kind of vision, for the ability to look past today and the problems of today and imagine a better future. So when I think about what is going to inspire young people, it's a sense that there's a better future out there that they can be part of producing, part of creating. And if you look at what happened in 2016, that's exactly what they responded to.
And speaking of single payer and taking it back more towards California and locally here, that is not only an issue for Senator Sanders right now, but also one earlier this year in the California legislature as a bill was advanced that would advocate just that. It eventually died. There was some discussion of whether that was really a serious proposal and the ability for the state to pay for it. Where do you fall on something like single payer? Is it time for California to explore that? And how would such a massive change take place, in your view, if that's a good idea?
Well, first of all, let me say that what we've seen in terms of healthcare this year is really two things. First of all, we've seen that 2017 in Washington, D.C. so far has been proof that healthcare is a right in the United States of America. All of those attempts by the Republican Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act, unsuccessful attempts, failed attempts, revolved around the idea that you cannot take away their health care from tens of millions of Americans. Health care is now a right in the United States of America. That's the first thing that happened this year. But the second thing that happened this year is an increasing realization, which I completely agree with, that we have an out-of-control health care system. Not because the Affordable Care Act is bad, not because we're running it well. In fact, in California, it's been a great success. But it's also true that if you have health care as a right, the question becomes, how do we deliver the best health care at the lowest possible price to every American? And if you look around the world, the systems that do that the best are the kinds of systems that Senator Sanders is talking about, which is Medicare for all or single payer. And the question that, so I take that extremely seriously. I think we're going that way, and we should be going that way, and I wholeheartedly support it. And the question about this, which I think is a very detailed question, is how do we get there? We have an existing system that delivers health care. We can't suddenly snap our fingers and pretend we have another system. There are innumerable institutions, companies, and systems set up to deliver that healthcare. So there is a very real question, first of all, that we decide together that we're going towards single payer. And then there's a question of how to get there. What is the glide path for getting there? And I think that's something that we're going to be debating over the next couple of years. And I think the work has not yet been done fully on that. And so when I think the proposal was made in Sacramento, I think it's a very serious proposal because I think it's making this, it's acknowledging and demanding awareness of the two points about 2017. Healthcare is a right. Now we need to deliver the best healthcare at the lowest possible price to every American. So I think that we are in this process. It's an extremely important one. I think it will enable us to drop prices. I think it will enable us to improve care. And so I think that as we go about this, there is a lot of heavy lifting to be done. I know some of the people who are doing it. I don't think anyone thinks we've done all of the analysis and all of the research. But unlike the Republicans, we will do it. We will actually do full analysis and understand where it's going. I think the Affordable Care Act has been a huge positive first step. but there is definitely a second step that's necessary.
Do you think California could go it alone, or is this something that is best taken on the national level?
Well, I think that, you know, that's going to be a question, Joe, of how the money works. You know, we have a system where we pay taxes at two different levels. And so we're paying a lot of money into the federal government for health care. If we continue to, you can't have it both ways. You can't spend that money at the federal level and at the state level. So in a sense, it's a question of how do we afford to do this using the money that we have, just using it in a concerted fashion. And that's one of the things that's got to be studied.
So you started NextGen, moving on to your organization as a climate change nonprofit focused on that issue. It's since changed its focus a little bit. Why the change there, and how has that played out?
Well, let me just give you our mission statement. Our mission statement is to act politically to prevent climate disaster, promote prosperity, and protect the fundamental rights of every American. So it's a pretty broad group. It really, and I think that it comes out of the, we changed our name because we realized that, in fact, for years we had been working on a host of related issues and concerns and policy areas. And so really, it wasn't that we changed, it's that we recognized the change that we'd made several years before. And I think that it reflects a fundamental belief on our part that the way that change will come in our society, whether it has to do with fair rules in the marketplace for working people, whether it comes about energy and climate legislation, whether it comes about clean water in the Central Valley or incarceration or the rights of immigrants, it will be a coalition of people working together across interest areas and policy areas as opposed to siloed single-issued groups. And so I think what our group reflects is what is true, that in our grassroots work, we have 65 partners in the state of California, that we partner with, you know, a large number of groups in Fresno, that we work together. And some of those groups are specifically immigrants' rights groups, and some of them are, focused on LGBTQ rights, and some of them are focused on our organizations of labor unions. So we have a number of partners, and I think that what we're saying is we will work with them across issue areas, that we will succeed together, and that it is a broad agenda that will work, that we will either stand or fall together as a coalition.
Before we go, speaking of clean water, I know you've been active on that. SB 623 was held over in September in the legislature, meaning it'll come back up again next year. So maybe a temporary victory, not quite a defeat, but not quite a win. This would have provided funding for communities who lack access to clean drinking water right now. Why get involved in this? It's a pretty local thing that's specific to some communities here in the San Joaquin Valley. Why did this catch your radar?
Joe, honestly, clean water is a justice issue for us. The idea that poor rural communities and the people living there don't have a right to drink safe drinking water, healthy drinking water, just seems wrong. And, you know, after, I think, we've all seen what happened in Flint. I think that everybody has a right to clean water and to safe drinking water. So from our standpoint, it really is about justice. Honestly, we just don't think that that's right.
We've been talking with investment manager, Democratic fundraiser, and potential political candidate Tom Steyer. He's the founder of the group NextGen America, which started out as a climate change nonprofit and now is focusing on a number of issues across California, including here in the Central Valley. He's also rumored to be considering political office in some form. As he said in our interview today, noncommittal on that at this point, though. Tom Steyer, thanks so much for joining us.
Joe, it's incredibly fun to be on here. Honestly, thank you for having me.
And that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. Send us an email. We're talk@kvpr.org, and find all of our stories, podcasts, and the Struggling for Care special report on healthcare on our website, kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess, Kerry Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, and our newest addition to the FM 89 news team, Laura Tsutsui, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.